all of the members, especially those that traveled a long distance, and also our guests and testifiers. Special welcome to those that came a long distance, yeah, Representative Hornstein.
We hung out at the NCSL.
Yeah, I know.
And this is the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government. We have a special advisory position. We are a commission. We are not a committee of the legislature. And our actions here are merely advisory. And I think what we're going to do is, as soon as we get a quorum, then we'll ask people to introduce themselves. So I won't do that, first of all. If anybody has any questions about the commissioner, we haven't met since last session. What we do is we look at the tax rate and dollar amount of the Metropolitan Council's property tax levies and any proposed increases in the rate or dollar amount, and give recommendations to the legislature. Any requests for an increase in the debt of the Metropolitan Council, the overall work and role of Metropolitan Government, and the Metropolitan Council's proposed operating and capital budgets, work program, and capital improvement program. In addition, we look at the Metropolitan Council's implementation of operating and capital budgets, work program, and capital improvement. Agenda for today is brief, and I believe we do have copies of it for all that are interested. And I just want to make one mention about a change in the agenda that we did last week, and that was discuss the governance of the Metropolitan Council. Most of us are interested in that, but we had that on the agenda for a June meeting, but there were no other agenda items, so we chose to just defer that meeting until later. I kept it on the agenda for this meeting, but we're so close to having a change in the legislature that what I decided is we would hold this until just after the legislature changes, that we would have a little bit better feel for who's going to be involved and what their opinions are, and if they the new members would like to be a part of that. So we have an agenda that includes covering the lines, the transit lines that we have. We have something about the transportation funding and a little bit about park policy. We're still Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I understand and appreciate taking that off the agenda, but I just wanted to say that I hope shortly after the election we can convene, and usually that time of year the Met Council has their budget and we go over their budget, and so hopefully we can have a meeting where we go over their budget and start this discussion about governance, because I think it's critical. I'm hearing a lot more about this now than I have even in past years, and we have folks on both sides of the aisle that are interested in that, so if we can make sure that that's on the agenda, and that we meet towards the end of the year both to review the budget and to have an initial conversation about governance. And I did introduce a bill 2 or 3 years ago. I don't remember. And I'll forward that to you, Mr. Chair, and maybe we can use that as a jumping-off point. But as long as we can have that on the agenda, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. And you're absolutely right. We will be talking about that. And just another aspect of that is that it seems like whenever there's a legislature change, we have new perspectives on it. And I know that we've had meetings in the past, and we've gotten some good information on it. And I don't think there's a one of us that doesn't really want to make some to bring it up to the surface. And did you have a question, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to echo Representative Hornstein's sentiments, and I think it is becoming more and more of a burning question and a burning issue. So I appreciate that we will be taking that up. And, of course, after the new year, then I think the gavel comes back to the House with this commission. Back and forth every biennium. So also just curious, we have an extra packet here for transportation funding sources and so forth. And some issues on the park. When was that posted so that the public was made aware of that?
I believe it was, thank you, Representative. That was last week that we made that change, I think it was last Friday, or Thursday or Friday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's still not on this agenda, so I'm just wondering how the public was aware of it. I didn't see it on what on the information that I was that I received.
Okay, Representative Scott, thank you. The transportation funding issue has been just that's something that's kind of part of the transit presentation that Mr. Shetton is going to present, and the, primarily that was just to answer a question of mine. We have a lot of misconception about transfers between transportation funds and transit funds, excuse me, and I wanted Mr. Shetton to make that clear that there is not a transfer of those funds. So that's what he's going to speak about. It's not really a anything in depth or any numbers that are going to be presented. It's more of a what the policy is and what the policy has been for forever, really.
Thank you.
Now, I believe we do have a quorum. According to our committee administration, we do not need four senators. Oh, we have, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. We now have a quorum at, and it is right now 1:18, so we have a quorum. Thank you very much. And we will start with the agenda. Mr. Shetland.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council, and as you can see by the agenda, we have a lot of ground to cover today. And Representative Scott, the packet that is in your the presentation that's in your file, we may have taken that a bit further than what Senator Carlson had asked for, but we were trying to be thorough as well. So he had asked a simple question, and we kind of really went into vetting about how all of the transportation and transit road funds, where they aren't commingled and where they are, just to be able to hopefully answer some questions about what funds can be used for what purposes. So with that, the first thing that, we'd like to speak to you about is to give you an update on the Green Line, also known as the Central Corridor. And then following that, we will give a update on the Green Line Extension, which is the Southwest LRT plan. And for the update on the Green Line, I'm going to ask Brian Lamb, who's our general manager for Metro Transit, to come up and cover that. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Could I pause for just a moment for a couple of housekeeping items here? We did not approve our minutes, and what we need to do is entertain a motion to do that. And then what I'd like to do is just go around the table now that we have a quorum for everyone to introduce themselves so that we all know the names.
Mr. Chair, I'll move approval of the minutes of the November 20th, 2013 meeting.
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the minutes of the, what was that date?
November 20th.
13 meeting. See, didn't we approve those in the spring when we had our first meeting? We'll improve. We'll improve them twice. But we will improve the minutes. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Same sign. Minutes are hereby approved. And now let's go around the table just to be sure that we point out the members and staff. And I'd like to start with Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mary Liz Holberg, State Rep from Lakeville.
Good afternoon. I'm Julianne Ortman, State Senator from Chanhassen.
Bev Scalzi, State Senator from Little Canada. Eight Ramsey County cities from Badness Heights to Moundsview.
Mr. Chair, I'm State Senator Scott Dibble from Minneapolis. I chair the Transportation Public Safety Committee.
And I'm State Senator Jim Carlson. I represent the areas of Burnsville and Eagan. And this is my first meeting as chair.
I'm State Representative Mike Freiberg. I represent all or parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, New Hope, and Robbinsdale. And this is my first meeting as vice chair.
Hi, good afternoon. Frank Bornstein, State Representative from Minneapolis, and I chair the Transportation Finance Committee in the House.
I'm Peggy Scott. I am a representative from Andover, and I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and a little bit of Ramsey, City of Ramsey.
Good afternoon. I'm Linda Runbeck, and I represent six cities in the southeast corner of Anoka County.
And Jamie.
Jamie Hyman with the LCC.
And any staff here? Mike?
Mike Wardrow, the legislative assistant to Senator Carlson.
Any of your other of your staff here? Thank you very much. And Mr. Lamb, please continue.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Lamb. I'm general manager for Metro Transit, and I'm here. I want to give you an update on the Green Line, LRT service that runs from downtown St. Paul along University Avenue through the University of Minnesota campus and then ultimately to Target Field Station in downtown Minneapolis. As you know, the Green Line opened for service in mid-June, and since that time, I want to update you on both ridership, economic development, safety-related issues, and travel time issues. And so first, let me start out with the ridership. As we all new starts, all projects, we start out with projections that in terms of ridership, both in terms of near-term ridership goals as well as fully mature ridership over the long term, and 2030 is our long-term projected goal. As you can see on this graph here, in 2015, by the end of 2015, we were projecting ridership to be about 27,700 per day, and each week we have averaged better than that since the start of service back in mid-June. Last week of August, the last week we have full ridership numbers, we actually achieved 36,800. I will note that that is the week before the University of Minnesota and other colleges along that corridor are open. So we're anxiously looking forward to the numbers as they move forward into September.
Mr. Chair?
Yep. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on the ridership. I remember reading that in order to open it, we had to cancel the express bus line that was, you know, taking commuters, something like 15,000 commuters into downtown Minneapolis, was it? And I'm wondering if those numbers have been subtracted or, I mean, essentially those would be a minus, I would think, to your totals. But
Mr. Chair, Representative, the actual totals for, well, there's two types of service that we've made some adjustments going into the Green Line. One of them was the express service, where we didn't cancel it. We just ultimately curtailed it. It had 10-minute service frequency, and now it's about 15-minute service during the rush hour and half an hour service during the middle of the day and no weekend service. That service ultimately had about 6,000 rides per weekday, and we still are averaging about 5,000 rides per weekday. The other service, however, was the Route 16 local service that connects downtown Minneapolis to downtown St. Paul on University Avenue. That was averaging about 14,000 per day. Mm-hmm. We did not cancel that service. We just reduced the service. It still runs on a 30-minute frequency as opposed to a 10-minute frequency. Right now, I think the numbers on the Route 16 are close to about 6,000 or 7,000 per day. So if you combine the two, and then assume that the reinvestment of the bus hours, because what we did was we took the hours that we reduced from the 16 and the 94, and then ultimately what we did was create a stronger grid network supporting the neighborhoods in the central corridor. For instance, we put in a new Lexington Avenue crosstown and that kind of thing. But setting that aside, that you can essentially say that those numbers took off about 10 to 12,000 rides per day, and then you put on the 36,000 that we average per day, that gives you kind of a net of close to, if my math is right, 22 to 24,000 per day.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since we're stopped here anyway, I'll ask this question. The 36,801, is that based on the number of tickets sold, or is there some other mechanism you're using for counting heads?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we kind of triangulate this in the sense that What we have are on all of our trains are what we call automatic passenger counters. And what they are essentially laser beams that are on either side of the door. And so every time anyone gets on or off a train, that breaks the beam, if you will, and that is one way that we account, and we believe that we've tested that system out, and we believe that that has an accuracy level of plus or minus of 4%. In addition to that, we have over the period of time have modeling in terms of how we look at ridership based on tickets sold at the various stations. And then we also have people that are out at sample times to look at load levels as the trains go by. So the three kind of sources, if you will, ultimately validate the total numbers that we report out in terms of daily ridership.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Scott.
The reason I ask is a friend of mine and someone that most people in this around this table probably know, my friend Matt, some of you may know him, he jumped on the train here next to the Capitol and went down near Lexington to one of his preferred eating establishments, and he got on the bus and says, well, or on the train, and he said to the guy sitting next to me, you know, what am I supposed to do with this ticket? What are we supposed to do with him? And he goes, oh, it's free, man. So my concern is, you know, that's why I'm concerned about how this is being counted. So we're making sure that people are paying to get on and it doesn't become free transportation for people.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that is also a concern of ours. We do have 22 dedicated full-time police that are there. Full-time job is to ensure fair enforcement. And what we've done is, I think the number is over 117,000. I'll have to verify that. Fair checks that we've done thus far in the couple months of Green Line operation. And they are it's a proof of payment system. And the fair compliance rate is over 98%. What we have done in the first couple of months is to for those who are in violation, who can't produce proof of payment, they are subject to a ticket and a fine of $185, $187. The first couple of months, we've used that more as an educational tool with a warning, but their information goes into the police officer system, and so if anyone is warned more than once, it results in an automatic ticket and fine. And so when I'm talking about a warning, that also goes against that fair compliance. So people that are either fined, ticketed and fined, or warned are part of that less than 2% that of the total checks that we have done.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor this, but so what kind of recovery do you get when you issue a fine of $180 to someone for $1.75 ticket? How apt are those people to pay the fine?
Mr. Lynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that's a really good question, and I've asked our police to go and find out what the fair payment rate has been in terms of the number of people actually go. And we're doing that analysis as we speak. I will say, though, an unpaid fare, just like an unpaid ticket, if you were parking or anything like that, ends up being a warrant. And a warrant, ultimately, if you are under warrant and you're stopped, that can lead to an arrest. And I think that we have very few of those arrests. We do have a very vibrant system in terms of monitoring those people who make a habit of trying to avoid the fares, and that's where the dedicated recurring police force is really an important part of our fare compliance, because they can spot the people who have had a tendency to repeat that same sort of crime.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
I'm sorry.
Representative Holberg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, quite frequently we have the media report your ridership numbers as riders. So, I know that you've seen it. I've seen it. When you have a 37,000, if you, even make the most basic assumption that they're going to and fro. At best, it's half of the number of people. And I've always preferred that those numbers would be characterized as boardings, not ridership numbers. Do you have any numbers that would tell us how many people are using this transit line that weren't previous on the buses? In other words, what did we gain, or the number of individuals that are using transit that were not previously?
Mr. Lynn.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, we do not yet, but the full intent was that we were going to wait until the fall when we typically do our rider surveys, and that way we let things kind of settle in, and then we can determine not only by this new service, but ultimately all of our service, you know, how many are new riders. And as a general rule, every year, about 10% to 12% of the total number of people that we survey, our customers, have been riding less than a year. So there is a an ongoing kind of new ridership, and that's probably the delta that we'll compare the green line subtotals against.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Artman.
Thank you, and Mr. Lamb. At what point on your ridership projections do the operating costs get met?
Mr. Chair,
Senator, Mr. Lamb.
We do have, I think, a very dynamic cost-effectiveness series of indicators. One of the things that at this juncture, with the green line actually at less than mature ridership level, we were projecting to have, if this is kind of one of the heart of one of your questions, is to have a fare recovery about 27 to 28% the first year. We believe that we're off to a better start based on these ridership numbers, and so we can report that when we get our first quarter's data in.
Sure. You said your goal was 27 to 28%, if I understood what you just said. And so your goal is 27% of operating costs will be paid for by the riders at some point. And I'm wondering at what point on this chart per day. How many riders would it take per day to meet your goal, not even just the full 100%?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, in order for us to meet that goal, we would have had to at least have 27,000 per day. Is kind of so we are based on that analysis and right in looking at our ridership, we believe that we're exceeding that. To give you a contrast, the blue line has been averaging between 36 and 38% of the total costs recovered through what we call the fare box or through passenger fares.
Senator Altman, more.
So, Mr. Lamb, will you be updating your goals? And I'd like to think that the ridership would provide more than 27 or 28% in terms of the operating costs. The people that ride the train should be paying for the train in the best of all worlds. Now, I know we want to provide some subsidies to get it up and going. We've got grant funding and one-time funding, but I think it's incumbent upon you and the Met Council to watch those operating costs, because the last thing we want is to operate at a deficit year after year after year. And so I hope you're going to reassess those goals and come back to us with a higher goal than the 27%.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lamb.
Senator, thank you. We will. I will say that it's part of the 2014-2015 Metropolitan Council Work Plan. Fare policy review is part of that. So how we set fares and what level, I know, is part of what the Metropolitan Council will be taking under advisement.
Senator Gibble, comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Picking up on that thread, Mr. Lamb, can you tell us how the Metropolitan Council performs as benchmarked against fare recovery percentages that perhaps peer regions are able to report?
Yes,
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can, and I can tell you that both from a bus system perspective, when we look at the top 25 transit systems, we're typically in the top 10% of those in terms of fare recovery. And from a rail system, we're in the upper third of the light rail systems around the country. And so we feel like the fare box works comparatively hard in our metro area. But as I said, the council will continue to monitor the fare policies as well as the fare levels.
Sure. Follow up, Senator Dibble.
And I know I don't know if you're planning to do the or someone who's going to touch on the transportation funding sources and uses, but can you just give us a little preview? What are the other sources of operational dollars for Metropolitan Transit?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lamb.
Senator, on the rail side, mm-hmm. It's easiest to kind of think of it as a third, a third, a third when you look at the full operating costs. For light rail operations, a third comes from state sources, if you will. A third comes from the county's Transit Improvement Board contributions to the ongoing... A
quarter cent sales tax.
That's right. And a third generally comes from the fare box.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Do Metro Transit riders pay those other taxes, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, they do.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Lamb is probably a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but are there sources of funds that are of taxes that are of general purpose that support road systems in our state? Property tax, maybe at the federal level, maybe general fund sources that go into our highway tax trust fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator, it is a little bit out of my wheelhouse, but I can say, yes, they do.
So roads are not 100% paid for by transportation-related taxes.
Mr. Chair. Senator, yes.
Mr. Lamb.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Artman.
For further context, though, Mr. Lamb, some of our bus systems in the state actually operate at a higher level than the train systems, right? I mean, we have some of the Southwest Transit and some of the other transits that have a much higher percentage of ridership funding the operating costs. Is that true?
Mr. Lamb. Chair, Senator, if you're talking about an individual route, there may be individual routes that have a higher fare recovery. If you're talking about a system or a subsystem, there is no subsystem of regional transit provision that has a higher fare recovery than our light rail operation.
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr.
Senator Arpin
can talk about the. What I'm talking about now are the Southwest Transit System, the Metro Valley Transit System. They are regional systems, they're bus systems, and their ridership pays for more of the operating costs as a percentage than the Green Line.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, the legislative auditor did an audit on this. Back in 2010, the results came out in January of 2011. They did a very detailed view of that. And, in fact, what Mr. Lamb just said was correct, is that based on just the overall service, not picking routes, the overall Metro Transit was the lowest bus provider. However, like Representative Holberg's district, she has the Route 467, which we have about 70% of that ride is covered by fares. We have other routes. Local service in the suburban areas has a relatively high subsidy, as similar to some of the routes that we may have at Metro Transit. But if you're looking at it as an overall average, Metro Transit provides that service probably cheaper than anyone.
Mr. Chair, perhaps at our
Senator
meeting
Orton.
We can have some of those costs broken out for us. I think it would be important for us.
Mr. Chair and Senator Orton, I can send out a copy of that table when we get done today, just so you can look at that information.
With the comparison to the lines, that would be great.
Yep, it's broken down by all different type of mode and type of bus service as well. So happy to send that to you. I just need to make a note to remember.
Thank you, Mr. Shatman. Any other questions? Mr. Lamb, please continue.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the things that gives me confidence in terms of continued growth and Green Line ridership. As I mentioned, We are nearing the 2030 daily ridership goal even before the University of Minnesota opens up. They did this past week, as well as the other anchor institutions. But that's where I really want to take this, is when you look at what's up and down the University Avenue corridor between the medical facilities and the education facilities, there's some real strong partnerships that are emerging, and so and some strong interest in terms of creating, I think, good alternatives for these campuses and work areas that where parking is a premium. Well, we oftentimes think of charging parking for parking as a downtown issue. It really is a cost issue and a cost avoidance issue for businesses and universities in higher density areas, because it's a trade-off. And one of the things that the University of Minnesota, which used to have a modal split, meaning transit user ridership of less than 20%, now has a modal split, transit usage ridership of well over 40%, is that they've been able to kind of convert former surface parking lots to higher uses. And that's really one of the potential benefits of having a transit system that works, because it allows for alternative development. And I want to pick up on that point in a second. But before I do, I also want to say that the Green Line, if you look from end to end, is well positioned to serve not only the daily commuting needs, but really for the special event needs as well for this region. When you think of the emerging Saints Ballpark on one end, with the XL Center within a short walking distance, TCF Stadium, which the Green Line goes right by, the new Viking Stadium that the legislature has approved the funding for, being constructed as we speak, and then with Target Center and then ultimately Target Field, you can see where special event ridership is also a really important part of how this works overall. Early on, the Vikings, as you know, are in their temporary facility at TCF Stadium, and the first two preseason games, we carried about 20% of the total attendance at those games on the Green Line. So we're off to a very good start. First regular season game, of course, is this Sunday.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned the modes at the university, and I guess my question is, I've heard that the last time this was discussed at the legislature, I recall a figure of 40% of the commuters in downtown Minneapolis taking transit. I'm wondering if the Green Line has bumped that up a little bit. Obviously, the price of parking is very prohibitive downtown, between that and the UPA and some of the other things, do you see this 40%? Are you forecasting this 40% mode for transit downtown to increase?
Mr. Lee.
Has it as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative, not only do I forecast that, but really the city leaders and the business leaders in downtown Minneapolis are depending on that. Access Minneapolis, which is their kind of long-range vision, really says in order for downtown employment to continue to grow, they're going to need to be able to provide increased access to downtown employment. So their vision is to bring the transit mode split from what was 40% to 60%. And so that was the genesis that led to these initiatives like the UPA, which had the double lane width for express buses entering in and out of downtown on 2nd and Marquette. That is the reason why City of Minneapolis is so strongly supporting kind of light rail access in and out of 5th Street as well.
And, Mr. Chair,
Representative Horton,
when do you anticipate the 60% kicking in approximately? Do you have a time frame in terms of the mode shift?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the target was 2025, but I will have to get back and really consult with the city staff who wrote and are kind of building towards that Access Minneapolis plan.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, a couple years ago when they were building the Green Line down University, there were several businesses that came and testified in this commission, and some of them were really, really struggling during construction. And I'm wondering if you have any numbers on whether their businesses have, first of all, if they're still in business, because I know some of them weren't able to stay in business throughout this construction time. And then one of the other problems there was so much of the parking was being taken by the large machinery and stuff that was being used to build this line. But I wonder if you have any numbers on if those businesses have ever recovered from that downturn for them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, there is no doubt that a multi-year project like the Green Line did have a disruptive effect on the nearly 13,000 businesses, if I remember right, that are along that University Avenue corridor. Through June, which is essentially the end of the construction project, we had a total of 134 new businesses open up in the corridor during the construction period, and 90 businesses closed on the corridor during that period. So there was a net growth even during construction during that period. Now, we can count, but one of the things that we need to do is to go back and do a more qualitative assessment, and we wanted to kind of get things back in the fall, a little bit of normal operations, let businesses, determine, whether they are seeing the net benefits or whatever it is. So I think that all the interested parties, the cities obviously have an active interest, the Central Corridor Collaborative, as well as the Met Council, we all want to have a more qualitative assessment of what business impacts were not only during construction but actually post-construction, which is really why I think you saw more businesses moving in even during construction, because they had optimistic feelings about what light rail would do to their business.
Thank you,
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair. I would wager to say, though, that the 90 businesses or so that you mentioned that are no longer in business don't share your optimism about all of this, because it was detrimental to them, and those people, lost their livelihood in many cases. And it's all fine, well, and good that we've made this line to transport people to downtown Minneapolis, but how many of them, ever frequented the businesses along there that went out of business? So what I'm saying is there's a cost to this in terms of people's livelihood that I think a lot of times is overlooked, and I certainly would look forward to seeing those numbers to see if some of these businesses that were struggling were able to recover.
Mr. Lamb, do you have a number of the businesses? I believe you had an outreach program also. Is there a count of businesses that perhaps you touched as within that outreach program?
Mr. Chair, I believe every single business was contacted, and that communication line was fostered throughout the construction. So I am not aware of any business that did not have an active outreach element to it. And Mr. Chair, may I also just kind of point out two more numbers here. There are another subset of businesses that did move during that construction period, but moved to other points on the corridor, and that was an additional 25 businesses, and then there were 31 businesses that moved off the corridor. And I'm kind of stuck, Judge.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, I know you weren't here when we had some of these hearings where these businesses came in, but the fact of the matter is that the people that the Met Council hired to be liaisons with these businesses, it was a terrible failure. There are people that had no notice of their water being shut off or their electric being shut off. There was plaster falling from the walls from the shaking, and no follow-up.
We had representatives from the Frogtown community come and testify as to that. So I hope that the Met Council has learned from this experience, and that the people that are these liaisons in the future, I just hope that they treat these businesses with more respect and more understanding, and try to accommodate them better, because the stories were very troubling.
Thank you. Mr. Lamb.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
I could just ask one more question on ridership. University being the line that was the most profitable as a bus line, will there be a point when we'll be able to compare, you know, the high numbers, daily ridership on that versus this new system?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, there will. We will be able to give you kind of before and after numbers from a corridor perspective, not just a route perspective.
Thank you.
Mr. Lamb, please continue.
Mr. Chair, the next thing I wanted to kind of update the commission on was the economic development that is occurring along this corridor. And we are not only the Metropolitan Council, but our partners are in the cities and the collaboratives are paying very close attention to the development and the redevelopment that's occurring along University Avenue. And I'm showing you this map here as a kind of a visual interpretation. Within a half a mile of the Green Line, 120 development projects that have occurred, stimulating over $2.7 billion of private and public and private development. Assisted in some cases by grants from the Metropolitan Council, and that overall, as you can see, and for those who have traveled the University Avenue corridor, could probably appreciate that essentially from the 1960s moving forward, University Avenue really struggled to kind of find its economic identity, as it used to be really where people went to go buy cars. And with the suburbanization of the metropolitan area, many of those new car dealerships ended up moving out to the suburbs, and ultimately many of those lots never really fully got repurposed. And we're seeing, as I said, over 134 new businesses opening up, but ultimately there are several high-density projects that have occurred along the corridor.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us a number on the average size of the grants that were given out to these entities?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that offhand, but I will definitely get that to you.
Because as I remember, the businesses that were along there, they got a flat $25,000 or something like that. It seems like it's a flat number. I don't know if Mr. Shetton remembers. It seems like it was a flat $25,000 or something, and it didn't by any means compensate them for the slowdown in their business.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're caucusing here, so I think the correct number was 20,000, but we will get you more detailed background information in terms of what those kinds of business-by-business loans, as forgivable loans, as well as other kinds of compensation that was.
Thank you.
The next area, Mr. Good. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Brad. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can please introduce yourself, too.
Senator Eric Pratt. I represent District 55, which is the northern two-thirds of Scott County. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, looking at your map and your economic development numbers, it seems to me that there are projects included in that figure that would have been developed anyway, and I'm looking at $1 billion Viking Stadium, some work on the Target Field, probably looks like the transportation building right next door, housing and development around TCF Stadium that would have been needed for increased student housing anyway. Are those included in your $2.7
billion? Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Lamb.
There are a variety of developments there that probably would have occurred anyway. The stadium is a good example. But if you recall kind of some of the locational discussions that occurred right here in the legislature about where the stadium should locate, one of the, I think, compelling selling points was its access to transit. So, and I think that is evidence there. Another good example is in the North Loop neighborhood. There is probably no area in the metropolitan area that has more new development going right now than the North Loop area. And when you ask these businesses why there, why this old industrial warehouse district, and its proximity to the transit system is really a big part of their decision. Mr. Chair?
Mr. Lamb.
I wanted to touch on Green Line safety issues. We talked a little bit earlier about the fare compliance and the dedicated police officers that we have there. I think one of the things that has been in the media and certainly a cause of concern is the vehicle and pedestrian accidents that have occurred through our pre-revenue service and then ultimately slowed down but still occurring right now along University Avenue. The vehicle collisions that can be summarized pretty easily. These are people who are in the left turn lane with a hard red left turn arrow and making an illegal left turn. And when you think about how you traditionally do a left turn, you're always kind of looking ahead. And what these accidents invariably happen is they don't take a look behind them because it's the train coming up behind them that, as they're making that left-hand turn, that ultimately is the cause of the collision. And so the cities and Metro Transit, we're working towards trying to figure out what else can we do beyond education, in terms of the audio visuals and not trying to create kind of a pollution effect, if you will, by having too much out there. It starts to end up diluting kind of the attention of the driver. And so we're working towards trying to resolve that. We had an accident of a similar nature just this last weekend. Now, the other types of accidents we've had are the pedestrian accidents. And again, one of the things that we're really trying to focus on is education. That takes a long distance for a 30-mile-an-hour train to be able to come safely to a stop. So part of safety is a shared responsibility, and one of the things we're really trying to encourage people is to look both ways, ultimately, and to ultimately try to remove, although it's a difficult task, those earbuds when you're around trains, because that is a direct contributor to the accidents that we've had thus far. In addition to that,
is just the fact that people are looking down at their devices with or without earbuds a factor as well? I'm particularly concerned around the university where the young people are like this all the time, even while they're walking.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, Lamb. That's exactly right. And so we've actually staffed at every one of the university station areas, staff the last 2 weeks trying to educate people to keep aware of your surroundings. But it's, in some ways no different than being aware of a car. It's just that the stop distance for a train is longer than a car, and so ultimately it's a personal responsibility that we're trying to encourage and reinforce. Two of the pedestrian accidents, we had two injuries but not fatalities, were people who are just kind of mindlessly walking in the right-of-way down the tracks. It kind of boggles my mind in terms of how you could use that as your pedestrian walkway. The third one, which did result in a fatality, there were trains coming from both directions. And she was entering the crosswalk trying to get across to catch the train coming westbound, not observing that the train was coming eastbound at the same time. And so that is the field of vision issue that I think resulted in that fatality.
And Senator Arvin.
The concern many of us had to begin with, that there was unnecessary complexity of trying to put these rail lines above ground where there would still be ground traffic and pedestrians.
Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that is one of those issues that we're going to continue to work on to improve the awareness and the warning elements associated with people who are walking or driving near the rail lines.
Mr. Lamb, is there any effort beyond the education part of it? Education, there's always going to be somebody who's naive about what this, you know, how to deal with surface rail. For instance, with that fatality, is there anything that you're looking at perhaps that could prevent that from happening again?
Mr. Chair, there are. And everything, as you may be familiar with, at each of the pedestrian crossings, there's blinking train lights when the train is approaching. So it's both from an audio as well as a visual perspective of things that we are looking at, locations as well as the decibel levels that we need to kind of put in place. And so both for the, as I mentioned earlier, do we have the right signal for those left turn accidents? We're really looking at that very closely with the balance of not trying to put too much stimuli in front of people that end up kind of having a neutralizing impact in terms of their awareness.
Mm-hmm. Please continue.
Finally, Mr. Chair, I would like to update the Commission on where we are with the travel times. You're probably also familiar with the fact that we are not at our optimized level in terms of where the total end-to-end trip time. And anyone who's taken the Green Line notices a very smooth ride at times, and then at times you're stopped at intersections along the way, and you have to ask yourself, why am I stopped here? And that's a good question. And what we have is a signal priority system that we are still working on in conjunction with the two cities in which we operate. And so this last 2 weeks, we went to a new approach on some of our minor intersections that allows us to what we call to have predictive priority, which is essentially says we were averaging about 50 to 55% of the time maybe not hitting that trap through signal. But with this new approach, with these low volume intersections, we're down to 2% in both directions where we're not getting the positive signal. What that's doing is the first thing it's doing is that the problem with the Green Line is that we were making the scheduled time sometimes, but not making it other times. So it was the range of times that was the biggest issue for us. We were running anywhere from, on the low end, 43 minutes from end to end to 62 minutes. So the first impact we're seeing is we're seeing the shrinking of that. So we're getting a more consistent 53-minute running time end to end in both directions. We are continuing to work, particularly in St. Paul, with them to continue this modeling and putting in this predictive priority system. We'll be implementing two more intersections this Wednesday. So we continue to stay focused on trying to provide a consistent end-to-end travel time and a smooth ride for our customers.
And Mr. Lamb, Are you finding that today's open door time is long enough, too short? If you get more ridership, are you going to be penalized by having to have the doors open longer?
Mr. Chair, boarding
time.
The what we call the dwell time, which is the time a train is actually stopped at a platform, opens its doors, and then shuts its doors, and then continues on. Our optimum is between 15 and 20 seconds per location, and I've been personally out there monitoring that, and we're right pretty much in the range there. It is surprising that a station like Snelling, which is a really high-volume station, how consistently everyone can get on and off the multiple doors on a three-car train in that kind of a 15-second time frame without any issues. So in answer to your question, we are not expecting that we would have to increase the dwell time as ridership continues to increase.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lamb, we've had some discussion about a couple of things. One is, I think folks might find, the slightly longer travel time than expected a little more tolerable if they kind of had a better idea of what was actually going on in real time. That's kind of a technology expectation that folks are familiar enough with now that they're frustrated they don't have it. So can you just share with us a little bit, because I know that that's been a gap in lagging and giving folks kind of when the next train is arriving information on the platform. And then the other subject is what's been observed is some of this accordion effect where trains seem to kind of get bunched up going one direction and for whatever reason, and so there's not really great distribution of trains going in both directions, but a lot going in one direction from time to time, very few going the other way. And so can you tell us a little bit about that issue?
Mr. Chair, Senator, let me start with realization that the automated management system that goes into running a light rail has, first of all, benefits for the system management. So I know, Senator, you've been to the Rail Control Center. You see that
actually,
we can...
I've never been.
Oh, well, I want to invite you to the Rail Control Center.
I've been to the Haywood offices,
will,
but...
But what that... we have a need for this system to have all sorts of data reporting back to us. And one of the elements, one of the modules of that system is the real-time information that translates back to the customer on the signs and the platform. That element we still have not accepted from the vendor because when they have tried to implement it, it has had problems. We continue to believe we're only a couple weeks away from being able to provide real-time information at each one of our platforms to our customers. We do believe that our customers will find that a nice amenity, but I will say that one of the things about 10-minute frequency is that the vast majority of customers will walk up to a station without really understanding when the schedule says the train is going to come, but that soon enough it will. Which gets to your second point, Senator, which is really, are we spacing these things, and what is the ripple effect when we are running these wide range of running times? Well, there are several fold. One of them is that, especially as you think about that, as you enter into downtown Minneapolis, that there's, instead of having a 10-minute frequency, you have the blue line and the green line running down the same corridor. So that effectively says every 5 minutes there'll be a train entering into downtown. Well, if the green line is 5 minutes late entering into downtown, then it can't enter right at the same time the blue line is scheduled to go in. So it ends up having to hold and creating an additional delay. And that's built into what some of those reporting times that I've told you. So there's some compounding effects. We are very, very diligent about making sure that we have the resources that we start each and every trip on either end on time. And we track that both eastbound and westbound and have been averaging between 97 and 99% departures on time. It's arrivals that we need to continue to work on. And once those start to really shrink up, Senator, those other things will all fall into place.
Thank you.
And Senator Carlson, if I could, I have one follow-up to a question that Representative Hornstein asked earlier about when the goal to increase transit mode share for daytime commuters from 40% to 60%, and that goal is by 2025. And that was from our friends from Minneapolis. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we can move on to the Southwest Green Line extension. Oh, sorry.
Senator,
thank you. One more question, and this was something that's come up in conversation, and it's also shown up in the press, and that is, and kind of maybe a larger question that can be answered by someone else at Metro, at the Met Council, or answered later, and that is, you're talking about economic development and that sort of thing. Part of what's been identified as adding to the success of the Green Line and its usability, et cetera, and that's all a part of the development picture, and which is presumed to be denser development than would otherwise have occurred, is making sure that we're accommodating for open and green space along that stretch. That was a significant op-ed that showed up in the Strib a few days ago. Are we thinking about that subject, working with our municipal partners? I see Minneapolis and St. Paul represented in the room. Are we cognizant of that as an important issue that we need to identify to create better utilization of the line, as well as the quality of the amenity and services that are provided along the line?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, that is something the council is well aware of, and we are working with our partners to address that. So we were aware of that, and the article only shined a little bit more light on that. But it is certainly something we can follow up with you on, but it is a conversation that's happening right now.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, if you would like, we could move on to the update on the Green Line Extension, also known as the Southwest LRT Line. With me, I have Mark Furman, probably a familiar person to most of you around the table, but Mark is here to give us an update on Southwest. There have been a few major events that have occurred with this project in recent weeks, so we thought this would be a good opportunity for us to bring you up to speed on that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. Mark Furman, Deputy General Manager with Metro Transit and responsible for delivering the New START Rail projects on time and on budget. So my focus today will be on the Southwest line, as we call it. Oops.
Oh, there you go. Sorry, Mike.
This one?
Press enter.
Okay. And so we'll talk about just the overall project scope very briefly. You're generally familiar with it, but it has adjusted since we last spoke with you last fall. The municipal consent update, and then project budget, where we currently stand on the overall budget. This project was admitted into the federal New START process and pipeline actually 3 years ago in 2011, September of 2011. And through our project development and municipal consent conversations over the course of those 3 years, the project has 16 miles from Target Field Station downtown Minneapolis through north and southwest Minneapolis, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie. That'll include 17 new stations. We expect revenue service towards middle of 2019, and the ridership forecast right now is a little over 30,000 per weekday, again, that being in 2030. The overall schedule for project delivery you see on this slide, and essentially we've completed the project development phase, which includes designing the line up to a 30% level of definition. Municipal consent, we have now completed. I've got a follow-up slide on that a second. The focus in 2015 will be further advancing the design and real more final engineering beyond 30% to 60, 90%, and the environmental review, which will include a supplemental draft environmental impact statement, which is currently with FTA for their review, and a final environmental impact statement at the end of 2015.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the status of the current environmental impact statement? Isn't there a draft done right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, a draft environmental impact statement was completed in 2012.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Scott.
And Mr. I'm sorry, I forgot your first name.
Furman.
Furman. Thank you, Mr. Furman. Is it that draft that local units of government haven't seen, or am I getting confused with another train line? It's environmental or draft statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it's a lot to keep track of, and so just let me look back 2 years and then take you up to the current, and then ahead a year. The draft environmental impact statement was published by Hennepin County, who is the lead of the project for that first phase of the environmental, and that was published in October 2012. Since then, we have three primary changes in what the scope of the project looks like, and that is one, where operation and maintenance facility would be located along this line to support and maintain the new light rail vehicles for Southwest. Two, in the Kenilworth-Minneapolis corridor, what would be the configuration of freight rail, light rail, and bike trail, and how those three mix together for that mile-plus segment in Southwest Minneapolis. And then thirdly, at the opposite end of the line in Eden Prairie, there have been some significant changes in the alignment. And so the supplemental draft environmental impact statement has been assembled by our project team, and it now resides with FTA, Federal Transit Administration, for their review. Our expectation is that would be published then in early 2015. Late 2015 then would be the final environmental impact statement.
Thank you.
Mr. Firm.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. We have a question from Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And also on the topic of the EIS, and I have concerns that it be done right and staged properly. Do you I see in your timeline heavy construction in 2016. Will there be any construction at all, any earth moved at all, before the final EIS is declared adequate in any part of the line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, the federal process for these big projects, whether they're a highway project or a transit project, does not allow for any permanent construction to be undertaken until the environmental process has been successfully concluded. And what that comes in the form of is what's called a record of decision, and that typically comes shortly after the final environmental impact statement. Now, having said that, Representative, I will say that as part of the ongoing environmental evaluation, there will be crews out this fall and next year doing some soil boring tests on checking for contamination where the light rail tracks will go. But that's just part of the ongoing environmental review. It's not any formal full construction.
Okay. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one more follow-up.
Representative Hornstein.
And I'm not familiar. We have relatively new issue that's popped up, and of course, Representative Holberg and others on my committee had to sit through two full days of hearings when we talked about oil train safety. But it's a very important issue for the state, and I have some concerns about this particular corridor, potentially becoming, it's an east-west corridor really, and the freight companies are looking for more places to haul this oil from North Dakota. Will this environmental impact statement, the supplemental, include impacts of these types of trains on the corridor? Again, this is relatively new since you've done the scoping. Is there going to be, I guess that would be one question. Then secondly is how is the EIS going to be evaluating this new issue on Kenilworth, which is the advent of freight? I mean, the old EIS, I assume, was talking about the impact of freight in St. Louis Park. So how is this going to be evaluated in the EIS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, let me preface my response to your direct question with, through the course of the summer, City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and Met Council all worked very closely and collaboratively to assemble and ultimately agree to memorandum of understanding that will, in essence, keep this corridor, this freight rail corridor through Kenilworth, in public ownership. And that we heard loud and clear from both our county and city partners that that was important. It's important to Met Council as well, because having that remain in public ownership, while not provide final and ultimate control of what the freight rail will be transporting through the corridor, it allows the ultimate public owner to be able to enter into a trackage rights agreement with the Twin City and Western Railroad to help limit the exposure through that corridor. Now, with that preface to your specific question, the supplemental EIS will consider the presence of freight rail in the Kenilworth corridor.
And then just quickly, so can you...
Representative Hornstein.
To the best of your, you know, your crystal ball, you said the final EIS will be... there will be an adequacy declaration. You're saying late in 2015. Is that what you're anticipating for the final EIS?
Mr. Chair,
or when would that be found? I know that there's a process where the public agency has to find it adequate, and that's after all of the public hearings and adjustments, et cetera. So when do you anticipate that happening?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bernstein, our current schedule calls for that to be at the end of calendar 2015 for the final EIS.
Okay, but just quickly, this is important to me and a number of my constituents. The adequacy declaration, are you including that in that projected timeline?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, that is really an FTA adequacy determination that FTA calls the record of decision.
Correct.
And my experience on these projects is that that will come shortly after the FEIS has been published and publicly vetted. Since it's an FTA document, I can't say if that's weeks or a month or two, but it's not multi-months or years. It's weeks or a couple months after the FEIS.
So late 20...
Early 16.
Early 16. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, then just continuing on this slide, the feds are a critical partner here, and they are a 50% funding partner. I'll show you the pie chart in a moment. But in 2016, we expect that we would then secure that full funding grant agreement for their 50% funding commitment. That same year, for three consecutive years, we'll be in heavy construction over the course of the 16 miles. And as I said, passenger operations targeted in calendar 2019. Quick update on municipal consent. This is a state law. 473.3994, some of us know it very well. And what that says is that any light rail project, not that different than a state highway-sponsored project, must seek and secure approval of the preliminary plans with the physical design components from each of the cities and the county where that project resides. And so this chart here that you see is simply our tracker that we used in the project office and at Met Council when we had to have the public hearing by law, and then when that local jurisdiction, City Council or Hennepin County, acted to approve that. And it was just 2 weeks ago when we got the final municipal consent approval from City of Minneapolis on August 29th. And that completes that that state requirement. And then I'll conclude, Mr. Chair, with a couple project budget slides. With the adjusted scope that now includes one shallow LRT tunnel for a little over half a mile between Westlake Street and the Kenilworth Channel crossing there in the Kenilworth corridor, as well as the restoration of the 21st Street station, the overall project budget is $1.65 billion. That is in inflated dollars, assuming that dollars would be expended over time, and they are escalated with inflation when we do construction in 16, 17, and 18. And so this is the current funding model that we have in place, showing the 50% funding from the feds, Federal Transit, 30% from the county's Transit Improvement Board, 10% from the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority, and 10% from State of Minnesota. And you can see the actual dollars amounts that would be generated by those funding shares. Mr. Chair and Commissioners and Representatives and Senators on the Commission, I would say then here's our current status, our snapshot of funding. Back in mid-August, the CTIB did authorize their full funding commitment for this project, slightly less than $500 million there. You can see $496. Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority did the same. Their 10% share is $165 million. The state, we have $44 million secured to date through a combination of general obligation bonds and state general fund that was appropriated in the 2013 session. So that's the skinny green chair, and then that leaves yet uncommitted from state of Minnesota $121 million yet to be secured. And then the feds are always the last in on these projects, and so once we have completed our funding commitments, completed the environmental process, then the feds will make their full funding grant commitment for their $827 million. Mr. Chair, this concludes my Southwest Green Line Extension update. Be happy to respond to any final questions.
Any questions from the committee? Now, we do have a testifier that would like to speak to the Southwest Rail. I'm thinking that we will probably wait until after we have the formal presentations. So,
Mr. Chair, I had a quick question.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Furman, can you just remind us what the anticipated annual operating cost will be for Southwest LRT? Just the whole number.
Ms. Chair, Senator Dibble, the first full year of operations, now that would be in 2019-2020 dollars, I recall to be a little shy of $40 million, 38 or so million. And that's built on the same model as General Manager Lamb mentioned, the one-third, one-third, one-third funding splits, state, CTIB, and passenger fares.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Shetland, we can continue
Mr. Chair.
Information.
If you'd like, I know we've got about a half hour left. Would you like us to walk through the transit and transportation funding, or would you like us to move forward with that and we could possibly cover the transportation funding at the budget hearing? It's really up to you. I'm just trying to figure out. I know that you have some constituents here.
How much time would you need to go through that?
I don't think it'd take much time. It more depends on the what the commission wants to do.
Any opinions from the commission?
Mr. Chair, did I hear there's going to be a budget presentation sometime in the near future?
We haven't announced that, but yes, we would like to have our meeting to have the budget presented probably within the month of November, maybe mid to early November.
Right.
So like to wait?
Yeah, I think that we could. This is just the basics.
It is the basics. Okay.
So most of us are probably pretty familiar with this, so we could just reacquaint ourselves at that time with this packet.
Okay.
That'd be great. Because I think these other two look pretty interesting, so I'd like to get to those.
Okay.
Yep. And Mr. Chair, then what I'd like to do is introduce Jason Willett, who's our Director of Finance and Energy at the Met Council. We'd like to talk a little bit about inflow and infiltration, which has always been an issue here in the metro area, but it received much more attention just this past June when we had the record rainfall in the metro area with a few issues out in the Lake Minnetonka area, and that really kind of highlighted the issue. However, we'd like to give you a overall idea of what inflow and infiltration is, because you'll probably be hearing a lot about it at the legislature this next year, so we thought this would be a great opportunity for us to talk to you about it. So
What I'd like to remind the testifiers is that we are an hour and a half into our time here. We have a hard end date of 3 o'clock, which we really shouldn't keep people any longer than they and possible, so I'm going to remind the testifiers and questions that we try to help speed it along. We have a couple of citizen testifiers, and this is very good and important information.
Great.
So thank you, and please proceed. Identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Jason Willett. I'm Finance and Energy Director for MCES. We're the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. And I was going to describe some generally about II and different parts and funding sources. And I can skip through it fairly rapidly if you would like me to do that. Give me maybe a time frame.
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Would that suit your needs, kind of?
I think so. Yes, sure.
So I'll go fast, but then you stop me if you want more detail on something. So the first thing I wanted to do is talk about what II is, in case everybody is not on the same page. The first I is inflow. That's clear water that enters the wastewater system, typically in a heavy rainfall, through rain leaders or basement sump pumps or foundation drains that are illegally connected. It creates a surge in wastewater system, although it's a short-lived thing. Infiltration, on the other hand, is when groundwater seeps into sewer pipes through cracks and leaks, leaky joint pipes, deteriorated manholes. That can actually happen over a long period of time, months or even longer. It wastes a lot of clean water because after treatment, we flush it down the Mississippi. In the illustration here, we've separated into sort of two different kinds. This has to do with funding also. Private sources, if you see that house there, shows you some of the connections, foundation drains, roof drains, and that little blue line is what we call a service lateral. It's the pipe from the house to the street. And then you can see the city's pipes there, or city trunks, and there are possible I&I sources there as well. So I would like to note that we think at this point that somewhere between 60 and 80% of the I&I actually comes from the private sources. So examples of things that have been and are going on in terms of mitigation, there are some cross connections that we've discovered and disconnected. Sump pumps, unfortunately, and foundation drains, particularly on older houses, rain leader disconnections, service lines, you know, sometimes get root intrusion or just deteriorate. In public infrastructure, there's a lot of studying going on. They try to figure out what parts of the city system that are thousands of miles in the metropolitan area are actually experiencing this high rate of flow, and they do things like smoke tests to see where the smoke comes out and stuff like that. There's a lot of rehabilitation that goes on of their pipes, and sometimes manholes need to be lifted up, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you. If I might, real briefly, generally homes are built to a standard set by a city or a county, and so at some point it must have been standard operating procedure to connect these sump pumps and drains, et cetera, into these systems. Can you give us some indication of when that changed? What would be a typical housing stock that would be contributing to this, or a sub-region, or I just have no feel at all for how pervasive this is, and is it really old homes, or...
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Holberg. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm finance director, so I'm not real familiar with exactly those details, but there certainly was a change. Sump pumps were allowed maybe in the 70s, do you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
In the 70s, and you know, before that, foundation drains in the 50s and 60s were standard, maybe even a best practice. So in older homes, that's the case. I do know in a lot of the suburbs in the Golden Valley area, there were clay tiles used in the service lateral pipes that have become problematic. I'll show you a picture of this later on. And that was standard. It's not just Golden Valley. I don't mean to pick on them. But houses that were built in that era have that problem in particular.
Yep. And Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, we'll follow up on that. I think that's a great question, because what you'll see in a future slide is that it's not unique just to one area of the cities. It's all over the Twin Cities. So I don't know if it's just that particular, those homes that were built at that point in time. But it also, if you've got a sump pump that's running water right into the sewer system, I don't know where that's coming from. That house could have been built recently. We're not sure. But I will. We'll find out and have that for you, because I think it just kind of helps set that background for what the real issue is.
Thank you. I'm trying to move on.
Mr. Willett, I have one question on this, the prior slide, where it talked about, or it shows a storm cross connection. Do those still exist?
Mr. Chair, to the extent we found them, they have been eliminated. We certainly don't want that. I'm not aware of any that that are in process right now. This has been over the last several years. There are some still designed stormwater, particularly like downtown Minneapolis, where the rainwater from the big buildings actually goes into the still somewhat combined sewer system. There's overflow designed into that system. It's very rare, and the city's been working on it for millions of dollars in the last 5 years, so I'm not quite sure what the extent is of that. But there is still a problem, at least, in that stock of houses. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
So the impact of inflow and infiltration, oftentimes when you're talking to me and the cities are, we're talking about the volume of wastewater. For inflow, there's really the biggest problem is the rate of flow. It's a surge of water that we get from the big rain, and sometimes five and six times the normal dry weather flow, and that becomes a problem. It exceeds the sewer capacity that's largely been built or designed for future growth, and it can result in overflows and spills to nearby waters. I'll show you some headlines. Here's some pictures of how ugly that can be. Of course, it stands a risk of impairing the waters. We also, to the extent that clean water gets into the sewer system, it's lost, you know, to the region. We flush it down the Mississippi, and so it's no longer available to supplement aquifers for the future. It takes up the fixed capacity in the sewer pipes. That last bullet I just put there because it is a sewer utility management issue that can cost us, and when it costs us, it costs the cities hundreds or even billions of dollars in other metropolitan areas. Right. So,
well, the point is we don't want to, Mr. Chair, members, the point is we don't want to have to go in with new large interceptor pipes that are only necessary because we're cleaning clean water. Mm-hmm. And as Mr. Willett said, the other bad outcome of that is that that clean water that we are then running through our sewer utility then makes its way down the Mississippi River rather than going back down into our water tables.
Senator Dibble.
And thanks, Mr. Chair. And I think it was touched on, but the other issue is treating water that in our water treatment facilities that otherwise clean. We shouldn't need to be treating. Right. So we're using
the other thing, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
The other thing too that we're being asked to do, I said on the Clean Water Council. So there's many things, many different parts of this. It's a dynamic situation, and they're being asked to provide some funding and have in the past. And currently they're not indicating that they want to in this budget year. However, I live in communities where some of the interceptor sewers overflowed and flowed into Lake Jarvis and in the lakes in my community. So Clean Water Council, who's using the 0.375% of sales tax money for which we all voted, are being asked to clean up the waters at the same time as we are dirtying the waters. And I'm just trying to think of a way that this can be corrected. I know this is a long-range solution, but these are short-range problems, so I hope that you can address a little bit of that because we know that it's a bad situation. However, it is occurring, and it is fouling our clean waters.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi. And we agree with that. And one of the points that Mr. Willett made earlier is that we think a major portion of where this is occurring is within those private lines that are owned by the homeowner or the business. And so what we have done in the past, and Mr. Willett will get to this in a minute, is we've allowed funding through the general obligation bonding in the past, which allows us to address some of the INI issues. But again, those monies can only be used on a public entity. And so we're trying to find a way to be able to use money that we can set up grant programs to work with the private homeowners to be able to address this at their residence. And so that is where we are trying to find a way to do that. And the Clean Water Fund was one of those that we thought would be a good source. But we know the Clean Water Council is debating what they would like to do. And, again, we will work through the administration as well, depending on whatever outcome comes through the Clean Water Council. But there is definitely an issue here that we're – that's why we're bringing it forward, just so people are aware of it.
Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman.
Is this just a metro area problem? Are there similar problems in other communities in the state, but because of the Met Council, you're focusing on this and providing a solution?
Mr. Chair and members, it is a problem statewide wherever there's old sewer infrastructure, absolutely. It is perhaps more of a problem in the metro area. It's been a focus for us, which is why we actually surcharge, and I'll talk to that about that a little if we get time. We surcharge the metro communities. You know, in the greater Minnesota area, they have lots of other sewer issues that you all spend a lot of money funding. This is perhaps the top priority, really, for us to try and get a handle on this and avoid things like happened in the western suburbs.
Yep. And Mr. Chair and Senator Orman, I know that there are folks from the PFA who can probably speak to this better as to what funding the state uses in order to address this, but I do know that there are WIF funds that the state uses in the bonding bill to help address that. And we have participated to a very little extent in the bonding bill to address I&I, and it's just becoming a bigger issue that people, I think, are really starting to recognize. And based on what happened just this last summer, again, it has come to the forefront, and so it's definitely something that we'll be spending some time on with the legislature next year. But it is a statewide issue. It isn't necessarily a metro area issue.
Mr. Chair, one more environmental consequence, which we don't often talk about, because this is about water that doesn't come to us. We talk about inflow and infiltration because that's utility management, but it's also true that sometimes, and this picture here shows a private service lateral from a camera in a house in Golden Valley. This was the clay tile pipe that I was talking about before, that after being wet for 60 years is totally deteriorated. So the sewage sits there and seeps down into the groundwater, just like a septic system without a drain field. And there are a lot of houses where this has happened over time. There's sort of a hole, a little cavern that the sewage goes through, and it doesn't get to us. But I think outflow is something that is an environmental concern as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to speed it up here a little, given your time. This map was just intended to show communities with excess II. So all communities statewide have some inflow and infiltration, and our engineers designed for that. You can think of that as maybe two or three times the normal dry weather flow. We assign them all goals based on technical factors and consider it excess and send in them surcharges letters, which they all get out of generally by spending their money, but it's really quite spread throughout the metropolitan area. Just a little bit, Judd's already talked about this, and you all are probably well aware of the recent headlines. This was a private inflow and infiltration problem that caused the overflows into Lake Minnetonka, a lot of concern about swimming in the lakes, and really some of the things that really care about quality of life in Minnesota. So we want to continue to work to avoid that. Uh-oh.
Just hit enter.
One second, I seem to be stuck.
Well, we both seem to be stuck.
Judd Stuck, too. While he's doing that, I'll talk a little bit about the excess INR surcharge program. This was a community-led program to try and deal with this. We were looking at, and this was like 2003 and 4, after we actually spilled in Bald Eagle Lake a couple times, we got together all our communities there and said, we really can't do that. It looks like $1 billion, the consultant told us, to build the capacity. This is assuming that cities would let us build stuff, which they really don't want in their yards. So it looked like about $150 million to deal with that at the source. Frankly, both those numbers are quite low, but it's very clear that it's cheaper to deal with at the source. And we continue to involve our communities in trying to design this program in a cost-of-service-type manner, to keep our overall costs as low as possible. I will point out that we got an award from the National Association of Clean Water Agencies for this program being proactive and making a difference. It really has dampened the peaks of flows. We've avoided that $1 billion of expenditure. And a lot of cities don't address I&I until they have consent decrees from the EPA and multi-billion dollar expenses. So we feel like the program has been successful so far. We had another task force in 2009. We were looking at switching to a demand charge and actually keeping some money and building pipes where there was still a problem, but the success of the program so far has let us not do that. So we have an ongoing, frankly, a permanent surcharge program, but we were able to ease back on the throttle a little and make it a little less hard for the cities. Nevertheless, in June, we did have a number of new events. So we still need to keep paying attention to this. I want to talk just briefly about funding sources. So for regional pipes, we have 600 miles of big pipes that go between cities. We use regional wastewater rates, and everybody pays for that, as with all of our infrastructure. For cities, when they get surcharged, or some of them are doing this proactively anyways on their own, they're using either their wastewater fees or sometimes some stormwater fees or property taxes and state grants, which is what Judd was mentioning. I have a little more detail on that coming up. For the private sector, however, there's very little of anything going on. And part of the problem, really, frankly, is the consequences are really invisible to the private sector. They're on the public infrastructure and the environment. So even though the private sector owns that little pipe that I showed in that illustration, they may not even know that until there's a problem. They may not know it's leaking into the groundwater. So that's been a problem. We do have two grant programs, which you have funded them both. But I do want to differentiate, and this is why we started showing the difference between the public infrastructure and private or property infrastructure. Because of the constitutional issue, the state bond money can't be used for the private property. So we did get $1 million, and I don't know, Metro Cities is still here, but they were championing that in 2013, and we created a first-come, first-service program there. Those funds were quickly subscribed. We did a pre-qualification. The work still can go on next year. They have a year to spend it, but that's not nearly enough, and there wasn't really much of an incentive. You know, we were only paying a third of the actual reasonable, verifiable costs, up to $2,000 a household. So in a lot of cases, it wasn't a third, and it was quickly subscribed. The municipal
infrastructure... Representative Freiberg has a question for you.
Representative?
Yeah, it's no coincidence you've mentioned Golden Valley a couple times. I happen to live in that city and served on the city council. You mentioned this program, the grant funding. Do you have any idea of what it might cost the state to fully compensate people for that? As you mentioned, it's only – I'm one of the people who took advantage of this, and I happen to know about it. As far as I know, it wasn't advertised – anywhere. You know, my sewer repair bill was something like $3,500 or $400, and this is going to cover maybe $1,200 out of that. The guy across the street got his sewer repaired about a month after me, and the funding was already gone, so he has to pay for the full bill of it, and we're just fairly involved citizens. He happens to also be on the city council now, so he knew about it, but he kind of took his time getting around to it. So, I mean, you know, if the program were fully marketed, you know, even if it's just in this form where it only covers a third of it, I mean, do you have a sense of what the costs might be for the metro area to cover this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg, thanks for you. That's a good question. Unfortunately, we don't have a hard number. There are some loose estimates that it might be $75 to $100 million, all things considered. We don't really know exactly, you know, what the condition are. We don't know where all the foundation drains are, or the service laterals, how bad shape. Golden Valley is particularly bad, as I mentioned. Sorry, you're sort of the poster child for this. I'm glad you at least got a little piece of the money. So $75 million is a rough estimate, and if we were to pay a third, $25 million from the state or regional contribution, it plus or minus quite a bit is all I can say.
Mr. Freiberg.
Yeah, and... you know, you mentioned that the foundation drains, the sump pump connections. I mean, my experience in Golden Valley is that those haven't really been found that much. I mean, it's basically the situation is the private sewer lines that are in need of repair, and that the vast majority of that's the vast majority of what's going on. It's also, mm-hmm. I assume, the most expensive to repair, of course.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Freiberg, I agree. That's right. Been our experience as well.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg, that's Chair. Also the... the situation where the state bonding bill isn't able to help with any of that.
That's a good point.
which brings me back to the second bullet here. So this year we got the third installment of money from the state bonding bill. The 2012 program, actually the money's still being spent. It was all awarded, also oversubscribed by the cities, but not by a whole lot. In that case, we're able to pay 50% of the I&I costs related to a project. So it may not be 50% of all their costs, but the I&I related costs, 50%. The $2 million in 14, the request for proposals from cities just went out a week or two ago, so I don't have results yet on that. But interestingly, it's less money, and the legislature did allow us to include cities that are at risk of a surcharge, so within 20% of their goal. So we have like 75 cities now instead of 50 or so, and I've got some maps that I will show you. So here's a map, and I don't expect you to take a whole lot from this other than this really shows you who's eligible for these programs. And again, they have to have been identified as a high priority somewhere, and it's most of the metropolitan area. It's almost everything. So we have about 75 cities that are eligible. The cross-hatching is the private clean water fund program. The brown color is the public program. So they're both on this map. And then we also gave you a map here of who's actually participating. Same thing with the crosshatch being the clean water fund program, the green being the state bond program money. So, again, there's quite a lot of need in the metropolitan area, and it's quite diverse across the entire metropolitan area. Sorry, I didn't quite make it in 10 minutes. I'll still try to answer questions if you have any.
Any quick questions? Thank you.
Sorry,
Senator Freiberg.
Sorry, I could talk about a lot. I know we're pressed for time, though. I mean, in Golden Valley, what we did was create a point of sale program where people selling their houses have to get their sewers repaired. You know, first they have to get them scoped, and then if there are problems with it, which there were in our, you know, probably 70 or 80% of the houses, I would say, were not compliant, and they would have to get repaired through lining or excavation. So, I mean, at some point, you know, we may switch houses. So I figured as long as this program was here, I should get that done. I mean, is that in your experience? I know other cities are doing it in kind of less stringent ways. I mean, in your experience, what is the best way for a city to get this issue taken care of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, that is not a state law requirement, although it would certainly be helpful if it were. Some cities have bit the bullet and done that, not all that many. We have a toolkit on the web, and we've had workshops. There's another one scheduled for this fall for cities to try and illustrate different approaches that they can take. That is one of them, and we thank Golden Valley for doing that. It's kind of a hard pill to swallow, though, and a lot of cities don't want to do that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Freiberg, that is actually something that we are looking at bringing forward, some sort of legislation that would have take that into consideration. We are just in the process of putting that together, but it is certainly something that we are thinking about, because I think it's only fair to people who are looking to purchase a home or sell a home to let them know whether or not there is that issue that comes along with the purchase of that property. And Mr. Chair, I think that's it for our I&I. I know that you've got some constituents here who you may want to. We can hold off on our parks piece if you'd like to hear from them first. It's entirely up to you.
I think I would like to. Now we have about 6 minutes left, and I'd like to respect your timeline also, because we did start 18 minutes late. So what I'd like to do is, I'd like to go long, but I also want to respect your schedule, because both of the issues that we want to talk about are related to the Met Council. Yep. So what is your drop-dead date here so we can fit these at least two folks in?
Absolutely. We have time to do that. That is fine. I know that we've got committee meetings and a transportation policy plan meeting out in Anoka County, and a couple of our staff already left for that when we were talking. So I think maybe 15 minutes or so we can hear from your constituents, and we'll follow up on our parks presentation if you'd like, and then we can go from there.
Okay. I'd like to call our testifier. What we'll do is, because Ms. Jenkins was on the agenda. I'd like to call her up first and have her give her perspective. And then right after that, if the Met Council would like to give any kind of response, we could hear that. And then we'll bring Mr. Rickers up and speak to the Southwest Corridor. So with that, please identify yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. My name is Holly Jenkins, and I reside in Eagan, Minnesota. Over the past 2 years or so, I have been pouring through documents and plans and budgets relating to the regional parks. And I'd like to share with you some of the information that we found and some of the concerns that we have with regard to the regional park plan policy. Met Council oversees the metro area transportation system. It's a terrific system. It includes a bike transportation network, basically a commuter network, a highway network for high-speed bikes. Met Council also oversees the regional park system, which is another valuable system, providing open recreation space to all residents while maintaining the natural resource base within the park system. The conflict that's arising is the integration of the transportation policy plan with the regional parks system plan. As a result, to accommodate the goals of the bicycle transportation network, regional bike trails, traditionally considered thought of as recreational now, are now also being planned as transportation trails for bike commuters. What does that mean? Well, these are not meandering trails wandering through the woods. These are transportation corridors getting federal funds designed as high-speed bike travel, meaning wide, flat, straight trails. And these are being planned and constructed through our natural resource-based parklands. Some of the concerns resulting from this include impact to park visitors, impact to the natural resources in the park system, safety concerns, and financial realities. I'll just briefly describe a little bit more detail for each of these areas. The impact to park visitors. Legislators in the 70s established this regional park system because they identified a need to preserve recreational open space. They were not setting aside land to use as future transitways. The use of our parks as hubs and thoroughfares for high-speed bikes conflicts with the very reason these parks were set aside and why people visit the regional parks to begin with. They go there to gather with family and friends, to experience nature, to enjoy nature-based recreation, such as viewing and photographing nature and wildlife, day hikes, trail running, among other things. Parklands divided with transportation trails will divide the visitor experience in these parks. The second item is the impact to natural resources. Each of these parks was established because of significant natural resources such as lakeshores, wetlands, hardwood forests, native prairies, and groundwater recharging areas. These are hugely important to our citizens. Now we have huge construction projects that are essentially going to build the equivalent of railroad corridors through these parklands. A recently approved project at Spring Lake Park Reserve. It hasn't started construction yet, but they've approved the plan to use explosives along the steep bluffs of the Mississippi River in order to essentially build a railroad corridor for bikes. And that's through a park reserve. That's not just a regional park. It's a reserve specially protected because of its natural resource value. The natural resources currently are being neglected, not just due to funding constraints, but also because of emphasis on built infrastructure. And every mile of new trail added will only add to this problem. The third item is safety concerns. These are designed as shared-use trails. They will mix wheelchairs, elderly, families with young children, toddlers, moms with strollers, on the same road as skateboarders, inline skates, and bikes traveling at 20 miles per hour or more. Accidents will occur as they have in other shared-use trails. We can and should accommodate all abilities in our park system, but certainly not on transportation trails. The fourth area is the financial reality. The initial cost to construct these trails and other infrastructure rely on a variety of funding, federal funds, state funds, local funds, Met Council legacy funds. Finding the money to build the things is not the issue. Ongoing annual repairs and maintenance expense forever is critical. And that is the issue. For every new mile added to the system, annual operating and maintenance costs rise, and it's a significant amount. In Dakota County alone, they have 85.5 miles of new regional bike trails approved. They're not all in place. According to those master plans, the amount of additional funds needed just to maintain these trail systems are $3.4 million per year for the operations and maintenance and setting aside funds for the long-term capital improvement. Where's that money coming from? Right now, Dakota County, their five-year budget is just over $2 million for operations and maintenance, and this is adding $3.4 million per year. So we don't have the money to maintain these systems without increasing taxes. And even with an increase in tax, there is a limited pool of money for the parks and trails. And as these operations and maintenance expenses continue to consume more of the pie, we have less for the natural resources, for the programs, and the other park services. And then if the funding isn't there, we end up a similar situation as Scott County is going through. They have trail systems that were built about 15 years ago. They are degrading. They need to be repaired. They don't have the funds. So they're looking for funds in Scott County. And in the meantime, their trails have become a safety hazard for bicyclists, walkers, and inline skaters, not to mention mobility disabled, strollers, and elderly. This is not something we want in our natural resource-based parks. Suggestions for the regional park policy plan would be that the regional trail system is a great idea. We want to connect to places, and we want to connect people to our parks. But once you get to the park, the transportation piece has to stay outside and switch over to recreational trails in the park. There is no need for transportation corridors going through our parklands. Keep in mind there are over 1,000 miles of these commuter trails planned throughout the metro. Nobody will be lacking for trails if we keep them out of our valuable parklands. The second item, natural resources in our parks needs to be taken care of. This doesn't happen without cost, and the legacy funds were passed by citizens for the main reason to protect our natural resources. There is a category in the Parks and Trails Fund to provide for stewardship apart from development. Unfortunately, those types of projects are not quite as exciting. They don't offer the ribbon-cutting ceremonies, and therefore our park agencies don't seem to be going for that. The amount of money from the Parks and Legacy pie that has gone to that stewardship is just a sliver. It's minimal compared to the millions of dollars that have gone towards infrastructure. What we'd like to see, similar to some of the other categories of spending in the legacy funds, would be a percentage allocated simply to natural resources in our park system. So those are our two suggestions. We'd like to keep regional bike transportation trails out of the parks, and we'd like to see a percentage of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund allocated to stewardship projects.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, Ms. Jenkins, have you approached the counties and stuff and asked them how they plan to pay for the maintenance of these trails? And if so, what has their response been?
We have asked them, and they've told us that they have it within their CIP budget for the first few years, and we've looked at the budget. If the trails are not all in place, so they don't need the money yet. If the trails are built, they don't have the money in their budget, and they have not provided an adequate answer as to where those funds will come from.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, our testifier has gone through an issue that she's done a very good job of making it sound non-controversial, and I can tell you this is really dividing our community, so I think it's something that I really wish we would spend a lot more time talking about. And then the other thing is the point she made about using transportation dollars for money for transportation trails versus the recreational trails. I mean, they shouldn't be duplicated, and in this case, in my community, that is one of the things that's happening. So, again,
one item
she's done a very good job of getting some points across. But
thank you. This is so complicated, and just as you said, I could spend the full 2 hours talking about this easily. Okay. But one of the other pieces to the frustration of the transportation funds going through the parks, some of these trails are being developed parallel to existing city bikeways. We're also paying for those city bikeways. But as one of our commissioners said, the money's there. Why not get it for Dakota County? Well, we have to pay for this and the existing trails, and they're going next to each other. So it just needs a little bit more oversight, a little bit more planning and collaboration with the other cities, for starters.
Thank you. Ms. Passy, do you have anything to add?
My name's Marianne Passy, and I'm from Eagan as well. And I just want to thank you for allowing our time, and also to emphasize that this is in Lebanon Hills Regional Park has been one of the biggest and most first openings of this issue of turning a nature-based regional park. And it is a very well-known nature-based destination park into a transportation hub. And that decision being made when the master plan and history of that park has very clearly been nature-based. And if that can happen in a park like Lebanon Hills with that type of history, we are hearing about and finding in the policy that it is possible to happen anywhere. And so that's why we're bringing it to your attention, because it is a broad issue for the metro region.
Thank you. Well, I think we are only scratching the surface, and as Representative Mason says, this is dividing the community. It's mm-hmm. And it's putting a wedge between groups that really there hasn't been a wedge before. And and I think we do need to probably, you know, chisel through that policy and make it work for all groups. And there will be more discussion about this in the future also. So thank you very much for coming to the committee. And now Mr. Rickers. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and begin with your testimony.
Chairman Carlson, my name is Ben Rickers. So first of all, you're one of the few people that pronounced it right out of the gate. That was impressive.
I had a cheat sheet.
My family has lived in Coon Rapids since '89 until we moved to Andover last fall. I worked for 30 years in financial management in corporate America. I've reviewed hundreds, maybe thousands of business cases over the years. I probably had always had some doubts about light rail, but because experience has taught me to expect that costs are optimistically low and benefits high. My doubts were strengthened when my daughter-in-law told me she drives past the North Star Station to ride a bus downtown in Minneapolis where she works. I decided to dig into the documents that presumably supported the Central Corridor investment. I want to thank Robin Kaufman at Metro Transit for providing links to studies and reports. The more I dug, the more concerned I got about the overall process, the presentation of data, and the lack of analysis of critical success factors. In fact, I was never able to determine what the Met Council had identified as critical success factors. My first observation was that there seemed to be no presentation that crisply laid out objectives, costs and benefits, both direct and indirect, positive and negative impacts, along with side-by-side comparisons to other alternatives. I've commented to many friends that the CEOs and division presidents that I have presented to over the years would have thrown us out of the conference room if we had presented in what I would call a data dump fashion. Some examples. There were no pro forma financials that compared financial costs and hard benefits for potential alternatives. The notion of excluding incremental capital from an evaluation of success is a new concept for me as well. Soft benefits are important to consider, but they were never estimated. A range of estimates should have been developed. critical decision factors, critical success factors, do not seem to have been identified, e.g. cost, for example, cost per incremental rider and overall commute time. The bus alternative was not developed sufficiently for any comparisons. There were no sensitivity analysis on critical assumptions that were used in remarkably precise ways. There is no evaluation of how technology improvements might affect transit assumption. For example, from the time the Central Corridor was first imagined until now, fuel and engine technology for buses has changed dramatically. How much more will technology change in the next 5 or 10 years? I think if you asked most Minnesotans who have little knowledge of light rail, 8 out of 10 would assume, they would just assume that these investments are primarily about reducing congestion, critical to shortening commute times for everyone. For transit riders, and again, this is from the study, not from the update we got today, the best I could tell is that each link trip was estimated to save about 5 minutes of a 40-minute commute. Assuming I have sifted through the data correctly, that has not a compelling rationale for the size of this investment. There seems to be no summary of overall commute time. The engineers documented level of service at a few dozen intersections, and their data suggests that the LRT will make most intersections worse or stay the same. In one detailed report, but not in any presentation summary that I could find, the engineers reported that the overall Central Corridor area will be rated as a high mobility deficiency by 2030, the worst rating mentioned in the report. How could anyone approve such a disruption, both in construction and ongoing operation, if the quote-unquote solution does not materially improve the problem they claim to work to solve? Given the above, I have wondered about the congestion relief and if that was indeed a priority. In the 2030 Transportation Policy Plan update, the very first concern listed regarding our region's mobility is congestion. Yet, according to the Center for the American Experiment, the $1.7 billion plan for the Southwest LRT is 3 times more than the MnDOT plans to spend on congestion relief over the next 10 years. Finally, it is clear to me that there are bright people involved. If anything, this is even more concerning. It creates doubt that these public meetings are anything more than a show, and very likely that this decision was on autopilot, looking for federal funding since the beginning of this century, if not before. And while federal money may look free to state planners, it doesn't look free to taxpayers. Thank you for your time today.
And thank you, Mr. Rick.
Happy to submit this if it's if you do that. So.
Any questions from the committee? Would anyone else like to speak to either of these issues or have their own issue to speak? Yeah. We convened at about 1:18. So what we're going to do is we're going to just go till about 1:20, and then we'll adjourn. So please state your name for the record. Yes. And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Carlson and members of the commission, I guess. My name is Catherine Zimmer. I am a resident of St. Paul. Oh, and I am a small business owner. I'm also a car-free and bicycle commuter. And I'm following up on Ms. Jenkins' comments about moving our bike transportation system into our regional parks. And I have concerns about that. As a regular bike commuter, I prefer to bike on regular commuting lanes. I am not one that thinks that I need to bike through wilderness areas and natural resource areas. Who's going to see anything anyway when you're commuting at 20 miles an hour? Also, I am executive director of a nonprofit called Women Observing Wildlife Minnesota. And our mission is to promote the observation of wildlife as a healthy recreational, educational, and scientific endeavor in such a manner that it does not disturb wildlife from their natural processes. I just want to bring up a little bit more about the natural resource issues associated with running more and bigger trails through our wildlife-based parks. According to the Minnesota DNR survey, 41% of Minnesotans watch wildlife. In the Met Council's 2030 Regional Development Framework, which is the plan that is currently in place, although I know there is a draft 2040 plan out for comment, they have identified four policies to guide the Met Council's regional work. And one of these policies is to work with local and regional partners to reclaim, conserve, protect, and enhance the region's vital natural resources. So this is first and foremost in our policies guiding our regional development. According to Conservation International, the two biggest threats to our wildlife are habitat loss and pollution, and this includes greenhouse gas pollution. As a matter of fact, just this morning, Minnesota or National Audubon released a report detailing the detrimental impacts to birds associated with climate change. So the more climate change advances, as we were just discussing, the infiltration and whatever the other word was, the increased severe weather events, not only are we going to have problems managing the water, but so is our wildlife. The trails fragment habitat. According to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, fragmentation has the following impacts. It disrupts animal travel, and it isolates populations from potential breeding. Habitat for species that prefer forest interiors or prairie interiors, such as orioles, tanagers, and wood thrushes, that habitat is lost. The same can be said for the prairie species, such as the meadowlark and the prairie chicken. Species that cannot easily disperse, such as reptiles, amphibians, which we often don't really think about, but they're very crucial in the food web, are more likely than other species to be harmed by habitat fragmentation. We have seen this, everybody has seen this. We've seen this with dead wildlife on our roads. I have seen turtles squashed by horses at Lake Elmo on their horse trails, and I've seen dead frogs and snakes on the trails at Lebanon Hills. Smaller remaining forests and prairies are more susceptible to invasive species. And again, this results in the loss of species diversity. There's an increase in the frequency of conflicts between people and wildlife. We lose our scenic views. And by losing our forests and our prairies, we also lose our ability to clean the air and the water and buffer our environment from pollution. In summary, I would request that this commission call on the Met Council to adhere to their regional development framework policy that calls for reclaiming, conserving, and protecting our vital natural resources. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Any questions from the committee?
Thank you.
That has concluded our agenda, and we will keep track of your notices. We will attempt to reserve a time in the second week of, roughly at the second week of November, and we will then cover the budget. So with that, we will stand adjourned. Thank you. Mm-hmm.